When Hashem sent Moshe Rabbeinu on the ultimate shlichus of man to take the Jewish nation out of Mitzrayim, and Moshe Rabbeinu was very reluctant and very resistive to the whole idea. And initially Moshe Rabbeinu had two specific tainas, two specific reasons why, after being convinced that it was appropriate that he should go. Number one, he says, "Who am I? What makes me worthy of doing these type of things, standing in front of Paro, bringing the Jewish nation out of Mitzrayim?" And number two, who says the Klal Yisrael are worthy? What makes them worthy of it? And Hashem answers back both of these claims. Hashem says, "Kiyeh imcha." Hashem says, "I will be with you, v'zelecha ha'os, and this will be the sign that I sent you, because the Klal Yisrael will serve Hashem on this mountain." Rashi, in commenting on this pasuk, says that Hashem answered him, "Ala rishon rishon v'ala achron achron." There were two separate questions that Moshe Rabbeinu asked. Question one is, what makes me worthy? Question two, what makes the Jewish nation worthy? Says Rashi, both of those questions were answered in the pasuk. The first question, what makes me worthy? Hashem says, you're not worthy. It's not in your merit, and don't think that you're the reason. Rather, Hashem says, it's my merit. You're just my shliach. And the guarantee that you'll be successful in the shlichus is, look at this net, look at this bush. This bush has been burning for 7 days now, yet the bush is not consumed. It burns and burns and is not damaged, isn't consumed, just like it has not been damaged. So too, you will go in front of Paro, you'll be my representative, and you will not be destroyed, you will remain intact. That's the answer to the first question. In terms of your second question, what makes you think the Jewish nation are worthy? They also may not be worthy, but they're going to serve me on this mountain. They're eventually going to accept the Torah. That's the merit for the Jewish nation to be saved. And that's how Rashi explains how Hashem answered back the two questions that Moshe Rabbeinu had. The problem with this Rashi, I think, is rather obvious, and that is as follows. Apparently, Hashem felt that Moshe Rabbeinu had some lack of bitachon. There was some issue that Moshe Rabbeinu was afraid. And Hashem says to Moshe, it is not your merit, but I want to give you an oath. I want to give you a sign. If you're afraid that you're going to go to Paro, and you're going to meet up with mighty, powerful armies, you're afraid that he is a powerful monarch, and you're afraid of being killed, here's an oath, here's a sign. You see this bush? Just like this bush burns and is not consumed, take that as an oath. Take that as a sign that so too I can save you. I'm powerful enough, says Hashem. I'm mighty enough to allow that bush to burn without being consumed. Therefore, I'm mighty enough to guarantee that you'll go in front of Paro and you will not be harmed. And that, Hashem was saying to Moshe Rabbeinu, should be your sign. Take that with you as your simon, as your guarantee. Fortify your faith with that. And I think that concept is rather difficult to understand. Because if we want to understand the greatness of Hashem, a burning bush doesn't really seem to make it in terms of the great feats of Hashem. And let me share with you what I mean in very simple language. The basics of our Emunah system is that Hashem is the Borei Umanhig, creator and one who runs the entire world. What that means in plain language is avalanches, droughts, dust storm, earthquakes, fire, flood, hurricanes, landslides, meteors, every physical calamity that happens, every catastrophe has been directly orchestrated by Hashem. But Hashem is not just the manhig of every activity on the planet. Everything in creation was brought forth by Hashem. That means the earth, the mountains, the stars, the rivers, the oceans, everything that my eye sees has been brought forth by Hashem into existence. If in fact you need a chizuk in your emunah, if in fact Moshe Rabbeinu needs some strengthening that Hashem is mighty, I could think of some very powerful examples other than a bush burning and not being consumed. If you've ever witnessed a volcano erupting, it's impossible to imagine the potency, the power of that explosion. If you've ever witnessed an earthquake, two tectonic plates rubbing one against another, each one larger than continents, and the earth begins to tremble. But not just tremble, houses begin falling, huge apartment complexes come to their cascading down, a power that's unimaginable. If you've ever watched and witnessed a tornado, and you know that 2.5 trillion gallons of rain will fall in a day, wind speeds of up to 170 miles an hour, you watch houses, powerful, strong houses being uprooted like they're straw men. You see the power of Hashem. You watch a tsunami, you see the magnitude of Hashem's power. If in fact Hashem wanted to give a sign of His power, of His might to Moshe Rabbeinu, I could think of many pure examples other than a snare burning. And the snare burning is an interesting nes. It's an interesting miracle that the fire seems to be right in the bush and doesn't consume it. But at the end of the day, if you want to show the power, the might, the gvura of Hashem, there are many, many examples that far outstrip this, and it doesn't seem to be the appropriate example to be mechazek Moshe Rabbeinu's emuna or bitachon. And yet, in fact, that's what Hashem said should be the oath. That should be the sign. The question is, why is it that specifically the bush burning should be the sign for Moshe Rabbeinu to be mechazek his emuna? Okay. Now, that being the question, I'd like to focus on some interesting background to help us see if we can understand an answer to that. As you're well aware, one of the most vital, necessary resources on this planet is something called water. Almost all cellular activity requires water. Crops, animals, humans. Basically, without water, without fresh water on this planet, life on the planet would stop. In fact, historically, a drought ends a civilization. That's one of the ways that a people ends, an entire civilization ends, because there's not sufficient water, crops die, animals die, people die, that's the end. Now, you'll say to yourself, okay, but we're not in particular dangerous situation, because as you know, 70% of the surface area of the earth is covered by water. So we got lots of water, not particularly dangerous. Unfortunately though, about 90% of that is oceans, and you can't drink salt water. Salt water is way, way too mineral heavy for our usage. It happens to be that about 3% of the water on the planet is fresh water and is consumable by humans, can be used for crops. Unfortunately though, about 3/4 of that 3% is contained within the polar ice caps. Less than 1% of the water on the planet is actually available as fresh water to be used by man. So here's the observation. We human beings have been kicking around this planet some 5,769 years. That being said, here's the very simple observation. If only 1% of the water on the planet is usable, so for a year or two, I guess it works. You know, you have a couple of lakes, a couple of streams, maybe you have an underground well, but eventually the water gets used up, and eventually the trees die, the crops die, man dies, and the human race should no longer exist. Yet somehow it is that we're still around. Somehow it is that there is still fresh water accessible and available. Now, the reason for this, I think, is very, very profound. The reason is because water has a unique quality that it can exist in three states. It can exist as a liquid, it can exist as a gas, and it can exist as a solid. And because of that, a very unique thing happens. Basically, there's a cycle to water on the planet. The oceans, which are vast and huge, are baked all day long by the sun. The energy that hits that huge body of water causes the water to evaporate. The water transfers from liquid now into a gas. It rises up into the sky. As those gases, those liquid gases rise, as they get to a certain height, there's a condensation factor. As it cools down, the vaporous sort of well spread out water molecules begin condensing, so they form those beautiful billowy clouds that we see on a nice spring summer day. What happens next is that the winds begin blowing these clouds to different locations. Typically, a mountain range or something of the like will cause an updraft, because the wind will come here, and the wind will then bring the clouds higher. When the clouds get to a certain height, they condense even further. When they condense further, all of a sudden there's too much weight for them to be airborne any longer, and it comes down as condensation. It begins raining, or ice, hail, snowing, and that water then hits the earth where it needs to be. But here's the point. The oceans are miles, hundreds of miles, thousands of miles from where the water is needed. just so happens to be that there are sufficient winds and sufficient arrangement of the mountains that these clouds should be taken far, far away, rise to the appropriate point, and drench down the water wherever they need to be. Okay. Now, that being said, here's one more step that's very important to understand. A typical, let's take a typical thunderstorm. A typical thunderstorm can, within about 20 minutes or so, drop some 125 million gallons of water. Now, that's an awful lot of water. It's a lot more than a bathtub, a lot more than a couple of swimming pools. 125 million gallons of water in a typical thunderstorm is an awesome amount of water. Why is it that when it rains in a given area, you don't have massive flooding? If you were to drop a few hundred gallons of water in this room, we'd be all sloshing around. Yet you drop 125 million gallons of water in a typical thunderstorm, and somehow it is that the water just is gone. Now, as you know, the water is absorbed into the ground. But a lot of people don't realize is how it's absorbed into the ground. Charles Darwin made a very interesting calculation. He was a naturalist, and in the process of studying different features of nature, he made the following estimate. He was in Scotland, and he estimated approximately the amount of sheep that can graze on a given acre. And then he studied the earth under that acre of sheep grazing area, and he made the following approximation. The amount of earthworms, aphids, and other tunnel-digging creatures, insects, under the ground weigh about as much as the sheep that that land can hold. You see, what we're not really attuned to is the fact that all earth that we normally plant is extraordinarily porous. There are millions, billions, and billions of tunnels. Because what an earthworm does for a living is it eats dirt. Literally, it opens its mouth, swallows the dirt goes down its body and comes back the other end, and all day long, all the earthworm does is eat dirt, consume dirt, albeit for its own purposes, but while it's doing it, it's creating tunnels. But miles and miles and miles and miles, an untold amount of tunnels. If you look at a typical sponge in your kitchen, the reason why it's so absorbent is because it's mostly porous, mostly holes. The earth that is anywhere, the earth that is inhabitable, any earth that can grow anything, is equally porous. And what happens is when the 125 million gallons of rain hit the earth, it goes down this entire series, these huge, unbelievably complex series of tunnels, and somehow it is that all that rain is absorbed in there, and the rain ends up just where it needs to be, either at the roots of the trees which are deep down, or it further goes down into the various streams and underneath the various creeks underneath the ground, and it manages not to puddle, not to flood, but manages to properly feed the earth. And when you study that feature, you should say to yourself, wow, somebody worked this out very, very carefully. The evaporation, the condensation, the winds carrying it, and it gets to a certain point where it condenses further, and all of a sudden it drops down in a tremendous downpour right where it's needed. But the ground has been prepared already with all of these billions of insects creating a super porous environment so that the water is absorbed into the ground appropriately. Somebody was paying careful attention. But it gets more interesting when you study a little bit deeper into the process. And let's ask the following question. How is it that the sun actually causes this evaporation? Keep in mind, evaporation is an energy-intensive process. You have to transfer a tremendous amount of energy to actually change from the solid liquid to a gaseous state. It requires a tremendous amount of energy. So here's a couple of observations about the sun. The sun, every single second of its existence, gives the following output. The output of the sun on a continuous basis is 384 million, 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 million watts of power. Now, I don't know if you can appreciate the number, but it's 384 with 24 zeros after it, which is such a stupendous number. There's so much output of wattage every second from the sun that it is difficult to even give any sort of frame of reference to the numbers. And I hope that that number, 384 million, 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 million watts of power, means nothing to you. Now, assuming that it does, I want to translate it into terms that we might be able to relate to. I don't claim to be clever enough to do the math, but I know some people who are. And using Einstein's theory, E equals MC squared, they translated how much that energy is. So basically, here's how it works. Every single second of the sun's existence, there are approximately 9.4 billion pounds of solar mass that are converted into pure energy. And the output of the sun is so powerful that every single second of its existence to give out that much energy, to give off that much force, 9.4 billion pounds of solar mass are disintegrated, used up. 9.4 billion pounds, which is an awesome number, which is difficult to relate to. But one more step just to bring this into focus. How much of the sun's energy does the Earth absorb? The answer is 0.0000000017. About 0.17 billionth of the total sun's energy is actually absorbed into the planet. You see, when you take an ocean and you cause billions of gallons to evaporate every day, and you're causing so much power, that's but a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the sun's output. The sun is this powerhouse. The sun is 685,000 miles in diameter, something that's so astoundingly powerful, and it's giving off so much energy that but a tiny fraction of it converts the seas that we experience into vapor without even shedding anything. And there's enough energy right now in the sun to last about 5 or 6 billion years. So don't panic about it being used up. What am I getting at? Someone made that. That someone is our creator. There was no sun, and Hashem said, Vayihi, and this stupendous, powerful existence came into being. Something that every split second of its existence emits 384, with 24 zeros after it, watts of power, uses up 9.5 billion pounds of solar mass to convert every second, and it happens to be at the exact right distance from the Earth. 10% closer and we'd be toast. 10% further and condensation, evaporation wouldn't happen. It happens to be the most powerful thing we can imagine, happens to be at the right exact distance, and it happens to be that this very complex system of the water cycle, of this evaporation being carried away, condensation, rain, the earthworms having dug the holes beforehand so that the water cycle continues and life on the planet remains. Which is a very, very impressive thing when you think about it. But there's one more step that I left out. You ever notice when it rains in a thunderstorm, you get something called thunder and lightning, very, very frightening? Okay, what is thunder and lightning? Well, if you can't answer this question that well, don't worry about it, because scientists are also kind of like a little bit in the dark about it. But they'll describe some of the systems. Let's look at something called lightning. Lightning is something that basically moves at speeds of 60,000 miles a second. In about a fifth of a millionth of a second, it will travel. It's 6 to 10 miles long. It's brighter than 10 million 100-watt bulbs. It pulses with literally hundreds of millions of volts, billions of watts, more energy in a single lightning bolt than all of the power energy stations in the world. And in a flash, and we're talking millionths of seconds, it travels from cloud to earth, earth to cloud, and remarkably has no known purpose, no known function. Now, when you study this, which I think is worth doing, I think a person should come to a tremendous sense of this is astonishing, this is wondrous, this is unbelievable, the creator of all of this, with such wisdom, with such precision, with such power, put all of this into existence for mankind to have things called water, to have weather, to have climate. This is astonishing. And when you study this, you say the words, Marabu Masech Hashem, Hashem, your acts are wondrous and astonishing. However, I claim that this is very important, this is very significant, and this will help you serve Hashem better, but this is considered nothing compared to one single activity. If you would like to really get a sense of Yiras Shamayim, if you'd like to get a sense of what it means to be awed and humbled by Hashem's presence, try the following Musar exercise on me. Some summer night, park yourself in a nice, out-of-way sort of camp, whether it be a park or something. Pitch your tent and go to sleep right there, out there in the open. Hopefully, you'll be fortunate enough that somewhere between 12 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning, you'll awaken to this thunderous, powerful thunderclap. And I guarantee all of the science lessons in the world, all the studying of lightning, understanding how thunder comes about because the lightning superheats up all the water molecules and they effectively explode, become irrelevant. Because what you experience at that moment is fear, pachad. If you've ever heard thunder, it literally echoes off of the ceiling of the sky. I know there's no ceiling, but it sure does sound that way. And it's so thunderously loud. And if you're awoken in the middle of the night when you're sleeping in the field by this powerful thunderclap, and you go, and you then do one thing, you make this bracha, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Shekocho, whose might ugvuroso, and his gvura Moli Olam, Hashem, your might, your gvura, your awesomeness fills the world. You've now done something that will carry you much further than all of science in the world. You see, when you study the distance between the earth and the sun, when you study the watt outputage of the sun, when you study lightning speed, it's interesting, but it's way, way far distant. When you experience a thunderclap and you go, oh, you have a real sense of fear, a real sense of pachad, and you're beginning to experience what it means to appreciate Hashem's awe, Hashem's might, and you're growing in your Shemayim in a way that all of the science, all of the knowledge can ever bring you to. You're now experiencing the power of Hashem right there, full force, and you're now growing in a very different way. And I believe that that's exactly the answer to Moshe Rabbeinu. You see, Moshe Rabbeinu was fully attuned to all of the majesty of creation. Moshe Rabbeinu was aware of the cycles of the water. Moshe Rabbeinu was aware of the power of the sun. And all of this would not move Moshe as powerfully as this sneh. Because this sneh was right there. It was right there and it wouldn't be consumed. And it was so vivid, so palpable, so real that it couldn't be denied. You see, the mountains are strong, they're powerful, and I know Hashem brought them into existence, but that's a distant, long, far-off history. This is real. I could touch it, I could feel it, and it doesn't make sense. What do you mean the sneh is not consumed? What do you mean it's burning, but it's still burning 7 days later? What do you mean it's not consumed? It's physically impossible. That was so real, albeit far smaller a miracle, but because it was so vivid, because it was so real, because Moshe Rabbeinu could almost touch it, feel it, it had a much greater impact, and therefore Hashem said, this should be the oath. Forget the mountains, forget the rivers, forget the oceans. This will be the oath. Why? Because you could feel it, you could touch it. It's much more real. And this apparently was a much more powerful lesson to Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore Hashem said, use this as the simon. You're about to enter into a tremendous nisayon to stand in front of this mighty king who earlier on tried to kill you, and to stand in front of the mighty superpower that rules over civilizations. You'll need chizuk in your emunah. This will be the sign more than mountains and the rivers, because it's real, you could touch it, you could feel it. And this is a tremendous lesson for us. And that lesson is all of the distant science, all of the distant facts are very important. You should study them, but if you really want to grow in your Shemayim, you have to experience it, you have to feel it. Living through a thunderstorm, being next to an ocean, when you scream out at the top of your lungs and you can't hear yourself, is a very vivid, powerful lesson in your Shemayim, much more than watching it in an IMAX, much more than reading about how many billions of gallons are in the Pacific. When you feel it, when you experience it, it changes your reality, and that's how you grow in your Shemayim. Okay, now, that being said, I have a 17-year-old daughter who plays the piano beautifully. I cannot describe the pleasure that I have when I hear her play. Such delicate touch, and such just beautiful movements. She'll start slow and then passionately move out. And she's trained very under a very good teacher. Her teacher played in Carnegie Hall. And I have such nachas, such hanah for my daughter's playing. You should also know that I paid a very dear price for it. You see, my daughter has been playing the piano for many, many years. She began in second grade. If you ever have heard a second grader playing Mary Had a Little Lamb and playing it a second time and a third time and a fourth time, Mary had a little lamb, and the piano is right in the living room, and my study is right on the adjoining wall, I suffered through Mary Had a Little Lamb time after time after time for weeks, for what seemed like months. And when she finally got it right, and it was actually Mary Had a Little Lamb, I had to go to the recital and clap. Wonderful, wondrous, it's magnificent. And then it got from Mary Had a Little Lamb to the next step. And if you've ever heard a kid butcher piano pieces, I suffered for almost 10 years as she learned to play step by step. Again, Baruch Hashem, now I enjoy the nachas. She's magnificent. But it was 10 long years of arduous practice and arduous listening on a father's part. Okay, why do I share that with you? Here's an observation. I recently, someone not long ago, studied my phone bill, and I spend about 3,000 minutes a month on the phone. Okay, 3,000 minutes on the phone a month on the phone is considered a bit of time. The reason I spend so much time on the phone is people call me up with childhood issues, personal issues. You should know for the record, I will never discuss a serious shalom bias issue or a serious delicate issue on the phone. And the reason is very simple. The phone is very good to discuss issues that are pretty straightforward and pretty clear. But you get but a minuscule amount of information via your hearing. At least 55%, if not more, of communication is in non-verbal cues. The reason that I will never discuss a shalom bias issue initially with a couple on the phone is because you have to sit them down and have to see his face, see her face, and it's a whole different world. It's not audio. There's a whole verbal cues that you're getting from the face that you'll never get over the telephone, and you have a whole different understanding of the dynamics, of the dimensions of the conversation. Okay. Now, do you ever notice that the face is extraordinarily expressive? I can easily show you a face of anger, or a face of joy, a face that might show annoyance, or apathy, or anxiety, or boredom. And in a flash, you'll know exactly what that face means. Now, do you ever ask yourself, how in the world do you coordinate the muscles to show anger? How in the world do you show joy? Well, I have a little secret to tell you. A piano has 88 keys on it. The human face has 98 muscles. And if you'd like to try sitting down to piano, playing it before you've played it, you'll probably recognize that it takes an awful lot of coordination to move the keys in the right sequence and the right manner in the right way. Yet the 98 muscles of your face are far more delicate and require far more sensitive a touch to show the distinction between anxiety, worry, nervousness, boredom, and apathy. Yet somehow no one ever taught you how to do that thing called, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm full of grief, I'm full of humility, I'm full of arrogance. No one taught you that. How did you learn that? And if you don't hear what I'm saying, I want you to imagine the following. Imagine you hear a concert pianist. The fellow sits down and his fingers fly and the music just explodes. It's magnificent. And when he's done, you walk over to him and say, that's astounding. How long have you been playing for? Phil looks at his watch and goes, 10 minutes. No, I don't mean now. I mean, how long have you been playing for? 10 minutes. I mean, how long have you practiced for? No, 10 minutes. The first time I never played before. The first time I sat down to a piano, I just played it. It just came out that way. Come on, you're lying. 10 years, 20 years. There's no way in the world those notes could have come out, that beautiful symphonic music could have come out unless you've been practicing for years after years. My friends, would you like to hear an observation by Charles Darwin? That name, if you haven't heard it, he's the father of evolution. He wrote a book called The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. And in that, he made the following statement. Instinctively, naturally, man knows to show emotion. If you feel anger, instantaneously, your face demonstrates it. You don't learn it. You're not schooled in it. Joy, happiness, apathy, boredom, whatever the emotion is, instinctively you know how to show that. For many years, this was a source of debate amongst anthropologists, again, amongst scientists. It's now accepted that Charles Darwin was correct. Human beings don't learn to express their emotions in their face. It's intuitive and it's natural. And if you'd like a demonstration of it, just watch something called Motherese. If you don't speak Motherese, watch a mother speaking to her newborn baby. Especially when the baby gets about a few months old and the mother goes, coo, 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 coo. And after a while of her speaking Motherese, the baby picks up and the baby goes, and you see the baby's face light up and you see the joy. Who taught the baby to sequence the muscles, to tighten the temple muscles, to pull below from over here? The 98 muscles of the face have to be coordinated in such a very delicate balance for it to show the smile. It wasn't trained intuitively, instinctively, and they've done studies from culture to culture across the globe. They found primitive tribes throughout, all of them instinctively have the same facial arrangement. It's instinctive, it's intuitive. People know how to express their emotion on their faces. And that alone, my friends, if you'd like to study the wonders of Hashem's Bria, just think about that. The next time someone gives you a face, happy or sad, just think about that, and that's an astounding concept. But that's not really my point. When you show your emotion of joy, apathy, sadness, grief, you're showing an emotion. Here's the deeper question. Forget who taught your face to sequence that way. Who taught you to feel that emotion? Who taught you to get angry? Who taught you to be sad? Who taught you to be happy? When you were a little boy and someone came over to you and took away your toy truck, you got mad. Your mother didn't teach you to get mad. Your father didn't teach you. You just instinctively, intuitively had that sense, that reaction. And when you think about the complexity of the human, there are 47 different emotions. All of them are instinctive to the human. All of them just happen. All of them just like that. And if you think the human face with its 98 muscles and the super intricate balance of its musculature is difficult to imagine, try to understand the depth of emotion from somewhat mildly upset to very angry to furious and to very, very joyful to feeling tremendous happiness. All of those emotions are instinctive and natural to the human. So here's the point. Go over to a chassan and say like this, Mr. Chassan, tell me, who taught you to fall in love? Who taught me to fall? Who taught you to fall in love? Who taught you to have that? I don't know. She smiled at me and I was gone. You see, it's natural. It's instinctive. No one taught the kala. No one taught the chassan. Something clicked. A little pellet went off in their chest and they're in la la land. And every time she looks in my eyes, I'm gone. Okay. Now, I want to share with you, I think this is something that's very, very important to understand. The Ramban explains to us that there are three levels to apikarsis. He says, in the time of Enosh, the world began absorbing a different sense. The first mistake they began saying was the Olam was Kadmon. And there was an entire group of people who said there was no creator, static state. That which is always was, and the sun was always in the sky, the oceans were always there, everything always was, Olam Kadmon, there was no creator. Now, if you can philosophically relate to that, I can't. I find it very, very difficult to even envision that, because everything has a creator. But apparently that was a mistake that certain people made. The second type of mistake that they made was the people and other groups of people said, no, there is a creator, but God does not know our inner thoughts. He doesn't know what we're thinking. He doesn't pay attention to what is going on in the human heart. Therefore, there can't be reward and punishment. There can't be any justice because God doesn't really know what's going on. The Ramban explains there was another group of people who added a different mistake. They accepted the fact that there was a creator. They accepted the fact that God might very well know what's in the human heart, but God doesn't care. He's not involved in the world. He's not involved intimately in the goings-on of the world. There's no Hashgacha Pratis. Okay. Now, the reason why I share that with you is because we are all way past that. All of us believe in a creator. All of us believe that the creator knows exactly our thoughts as we're thinking them. And all of us believe that Hashem is intimately involved in the runnings of our life. However, I believe in our modern day, there's a fourth level of apikorsis. It's what I call robotic Judaism. Robotic Judaism means, quite simply, are you aware that God's here? Whatever. Do you know that God knows your thoughts? Whatever. Are you aware that there's reward and punishment? Whatever. Time to damage Shemoneh Esrei? Whatever. Put on tefillin? Whatever. Shabbos? Whatever. Yom Tov? Whatever. Dead. The heart is D-E-A-D on arrival. From moment to moment, if you would take the EKG, you would see there's no brainwave activity, there's no EEG, there's no EKG. The patient has died. And I call robotic Judaism and the activities that we witness on a regular basis, people strap on a tefillin, Shabbos is all the same, Yom Tov is all the same, every day is the same, it's a state of permanent comatose. And that is a very real problem, because while it's true that we are maminim, while it's true that we believe in Hashem, and we certainly mouth the words that I believe I'm standing in front of Hashem, and I know Hashem is involved in my life, and I believe in reward and punishment, I'm robotic in my activities, I'm dead as a doornail. And the question is, okay, what do I do about this? In other words, if this is reality, how do I change? And I'd like to share with you what I think the only way to change. You have to take a very small thing that actually moves you, and something that gives your heart a jolt, and you have to then expand from there to everything else. For instance, if you were lucky enough to be lying in that field at night, and you heard that powerful thunderclap, and you said, Chekoho ugvurosom mali olam, you felt it. It was real. It was powerful. You felt real Yerushamayim. You can then do the necessary work. If that's the power that I experience in a simple thunderclap, who made thunder? Who made lightning to cause an intense burning that gives off that sound? Who created the sky and the sun? Who created everything? That's the work once you feel it. Once you start from a very small point where you margish it, where you feel it, where it's real to you, you could then expand to everything else, and you could really begin growing in a very positive way. There's a Ramban in Chumash that I think is imperative for every Jew to know. At the end of Bo, says the Ramban the following. A man who has no chelik b'toras Moshe Rabbeinu, he says, if a person is in the following group, he has no shaychas, no connection to Torah's Moshe Rabbeinu, until he believes, b'chol dvarenu u'mikrenu shekulam nisim. Unless a person believes that every action that befalls him is a miracle, every action that happens to him is Hashem's direct involvement, there's no teva, there's no minuk shel olam, says the Ramban, unless you understand that, you're out of the category of one who has a portion in the Torah of Moshe. Very powerful words. Says the Ramban as following, every single action in my life is Hashem's direct involvement. Hashem intimately involved. There's no such thing as mikra. There's no such thing as happenstance. There's no such thing as nature. There's no such thing as things just happen. It's Hashem totally intimately involved in every activity in my life. And if on some level I don't understand that, then I have no chelik amongst the emunah of the basic system of emunah of Hashem. Now, that is a big problem. Why? Because, quite honestly, how many people could say, that's my life. Every minute of the day, Hashem's right there. I see it every minute. Hashem's right there. Hashem's bringing me, holding me, carrying me. That's my life. Obviously, that's a very high madrigal. Now, let's understand. The Ramban does not mean you have to feel it, as did Avraham Avinu. The Ramban is talking about understanding this, relating to the fact that this is reality. But then the Ramban explains to us, how is it that a Jew should come to this high level, whether it be fully intimately feeling it, or at least being aware of it? Says the Ramban, there's one simple formula. Min ha-nisim ha-gedolim ha-mufursim, from the powerful miracles that are well known, are the modeb nisim ha-nastarim. From those, a person will come to recognize the hidden miracles. Shem Yisod ha-Torah Kula, which is the basis of our entire Torah. And says the Ramban, when you study Yetzias Mitzrayim, when you study the 12 portions cut out of the Yam Suf, when you study Dam Tzvadei HaKinim, you see miracles. You see and experience powerful miracles. From that, you then take the next step. If Hashem did that, that means Hashem was running the world. Hashem was present then, and Hashem is present here. If Hashem turned water into blood, then Hashem is maintaining physicality. Hashem is maintaining the molecular structure of water. That means Hashem is right here, holding this shtender here, holding the ground where it is, holding the clouds in the sky. From the nisim gluyim amafursim, from the powerful overt miracles, you come to recognize the smaller miracles. And I believe that Ramban is sharing with us a fantastic concept. If you would like to really grow in Emuna, you would like to transfer out of this robotic state, I have one simple exercise that I think will help. All of us have a story. There's no Jew who doesn't have a story. Whether it's how you became frum, whether it's how you got the job you got, whether it's how you met your wife, whether it's every single Jew has a certain point where they clearly recognize that's a miracle. And if you study your life, you'll find at least one event, more likely many events, that it would take a kofar be'ikah to deny the fact that it's Hashem. And all you have to do is take that one event. If it's your wife, how I met her, how I was in just the right frame of mind at the time. You know the story with the biggest balgaiv in Brooklyn who has to go out with the best girl in Brooklyn, get dropped, and then goes out with somebody who he never would have gone out with, but Nebuch, and it turns out that that's his bashert. And when you study, whether that's your story or whatever your story is, and you study the intricate details, and you say to yourself, wait a minute, I get it. That was Hashem. This guy came over to me at the right time and offered me this job. It really didn't make any sense. He should never have offered it to me. I should never have taken it, but I took it, and it turned out to be the best move. That means Hashem was there. Hashem put that thought in his mind. Hashem put that thought in my mind. Hashem orchestrates. And from that one small Yeshua, you then extrapolate. If Hashem was there on Tuesday afternoon, that means Hashem is there Wednesday afternoon, Thursday afternoon, Shabbos morning, and you begin expanding out. You go from the small point that's so clear, that's so vivid, and you expand from there to everything else. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu had a yedia brura about the wonders of creation. He knew about the mountains and the rivers and the oceans, but Hashem said, I want to give you something more powerful. You want a chizuk in emunah? Look at the snare. It's right here. It's vivid. You could touch it. You could feel it. And the stars and the skies are great, but they're too far removed. This is real. Feel it. Touch it. It's right here. And says Hashem, this will be the simon because you need to make it real. It can't be theoretical. It can't be abstract. It has to be powerful. It has to be real. And I think this is a concept that plays out in our emunah system in a tremendous, tremendous way. If a person looks out at their life, if a person studies the world, when a person studies nature, you have to be blind as a bat not to see some wonders in Hashem's world. This year, for the first time in my life, I said a bracha over a hummingbird. I read about hummingbirds for years. I studied them. I knew about them. And it was Pesach, and all of a sudden, I was taking a walk with one of my children, and the bracha blurted out of my mouth because there it was, a hummingbird, 200 beats a second, and doing backwards figure eights. I couldn't believe it. It was a powerful moment. All of us have seen parts of Teva that are wondrous. When you feel it, when you experience it, you have to shout out, Marabu Masech Hashem, this is wondrous. But carry it. Don't stop there. If Hashem created the hummingbird, that means Hashem made the rest of the ecological system. Hashem made the rest of the world. Carry it, take it from the concrete, take it to the abstract, grow it, let it expand. I think, in fact, that's what the Ramban is telling us. When you look at the nisim agluyim amafursim, when you look at the powerful miracles of Kriyas Yamsuf, what you then do is you expand it. But it's got to be powerful, it's got to be real, it's got to be something you could touch, something you can feel. When you study the human face, you understand the complexity of nature, but go much deeper than that. Study the emotions behind it, and ask yourself, who taught you to feel those emotions? And my friends, no one understands something. It is instinctive to the human to feel those emotions, and it's instinctive to the human to feel Yiras Shamayim. You don't have to be trained to fear Hashem. You don't have to be trained to be awed by Hashem's presence. You just have to be aware. Just like the chassan who intuitively knows to fall in love, it's pre-programmed into his heart. The minute you experience Hashem, you feel a tremendous sense of awe. You stand back and you see this tremendous power, And that's an instantaneous reflex of the human. It's right there. It's present. It's built into your very fabric of your being. But you have to work on it. You have to see the concrete, and then from the concrete expand. You have to take those events in your life that were powerful. You have to then learn out to other events. You have to take the natural phenomena and expand it. And when you do that, you reach a different level of understanding. You break out of robotic Judaism. You become an active, proactive Ma'amin in Hashem. You see Hashem active in your life. Let me close with one last step. And that is the Rambam in Perush Mishnayos says an Arichas, has a long piece where he describes a certain event that had happened. There was once this group of philosophers, and these people, according to the Rambam, were very wise. They were not Jewish. They were very, very wise, and they studied all of the features in creation. And the Rambam says that everything created has a purpose. These people studied, and apparently they were able to derive the purpose of each animal and all of the various parts. If you look, says the Rambam, if you look in Melachim, you'll see that Shlomo HaMelech had such wisdom. Shlomo HaMelech spoke to the birds, spoke to the animals. But if you look in the Pesukim, it says that Shlomo HaMelech spoke to the trees. Rashi is bothered by why would Shlomo HaMelech speak to trees. Says Rashi, it doesn't mean Shlomo HaMelech spoke to the trees. He understood and explained to others why each tree was created. Hashem created this tree for this purpose, this particular branch for this purpose, this particular type of growth for its medicinal purposes, and everything in creation was exposed to Shlomo HaMelech. He had the wisdom to understand it all. That being said, there's a Gemara in Brachos that says there is one thing in creation that Shlomo HaMelech could not discover, and these wise men can't discover, because it has no functional utilitarian purpose. Says the Gemara in Brachos, Daf Nun Tesem and Alf, Amar Rabbi Shuman Levi, Lo Nivru Ramoyim El Lifshos Akumiyos Shebelev. There's only one reason why Hashem created thunder. Thunder is useless. It's not needed. Lightning is very important because lightning burns up the static electricity. The release of static electricity burns up the water molecules, creates that explosion. That part I got. But who needs the explosion? Who needs thunder? Says the Gemara, it's not needed. The entire water cycle would continue. Earth would be very healthy. Mankind would flourish without thunder. Why create it, says the Gemara? For one reason: to remove the crookedness in man's heart. Says the Gemara, Shenemar Velokim Asa Sheyirum Lofanav, Hashem created it so that you should fear Him. Would you like to know why Hashem made thunder? So that a human being should hear it and say, oh, that is mighty, and that is powerful. The sole reason Hashem created it was for our growth. And what that means in plain language is there are many tools that Hashem gave us, many things that Hashem created specifically for us, but you have to be aware of them and you have to use the tool. The next time it's raining, stop and say that bracha with an intense outpouring of kavana. The next time you see lightning, say Osim Masa Breshis. Study an ocean, study a river, look at the power, look at the majesty. These are all things Hashem created to give us the opportunity. And when you take that and you feel it, you expand that experience beyond it, and you end up being a powerful Ma'amin and Hashem. Hashem grant us the wisdom, understanding, ability to put this into practice.